Good morning, Kansas City, and welcome to the very first edition of Central Standard Friday here on KCUR. Of course, those of you who've been listening in for years have enjoyed the Walt Bodine Show in this time slot, but we're going to be carrying on in his stead and probably trying our best to honor his legacy. I'm Russ Simmons with Fox 4 and KKFI FM, and I'm joined today by...
Good morning, it's Marie Asner with the Metro Voice News, phantomtollbooth.org, and onairprep.com.
This is Loie Lockerbie. I freelance for the Kansas City Star and write DVD reviews for kcactive.com, and I have my own blog, suchacritic.com.
There you go. Well, as I said, we'll be carrying on as we have for quite some time. We'll have the movie critics on Fridays once a month, and we'll also be featuring the food critics as well as Monroe Dodd with his Kansas City History Show. Those were the three topics that Walt Bodine enjoyed the most, and so on Fridays, those are the ones we're going to be covering. And I would like to say a special shout-out to Walt. As you all know, he retired after 72 years in the broadcasting business. We gave him a great send-off last week. That was just fantastic, the way he was here and was able to go out with a bang. We set a new fundraising record during his hour, which was great fun. And we really appreciate all your support and for supporting Walt all these years. And Walt, if you're out there, we love you.
Yeah.
And we're you're listening. We appreciate it.
We miss you already.
That's right. We're going to do our best to carry on in your stead here. And we're going to talk today, first of all, about probably the biggest blockbuster of the year. But before I say that, I want to say congratulations also to Walt, because he was named Kansas City Walt Bodine's Day in Kansas City yesterday by the city council, and Walt was there to accept that honor.
Oh,
and
congratulations!
Congratulations to Walt for that. Today, I think it's not exactly summer yet, but according to Hollywood, it is the first big blockbuster of the summer is Marvel's The Avengers. Loie?
Well, this thing will be carrying through to the summer. I have a feeling, if the current box office numbers are any indication. And it deserves to. This is the sort of monsters of comic bookdom movie. Imagine one of those Godzilla all monsters attack movies, but with Marvel superheroes, and you kind of have a general idea of what we're getting here, except it's, you know, much better special effects and dialogue. It's written and directed by Joss Whedon, who is best known as sort of a cult writer-director with TV shows like Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Firefly. And the movie Cabin in the Woods, which we'll be talking about here in a little while. But he's a huge comic book fan and actually got this prime gig of directing the Avengers movie, which brings together Iron Man, Captain America, Thor, the Hulk, Hawkeye, and Black Widow, along with several other peripheral characters who've shown up in the individual movies that some of these guys have had, all banding together to fight Thor's adopted brother Loki, who was also the villain in the Thor movie. He's got bigger and badder plans this time around, so they have to put together this great, huge team of superheroes. What's most fun about this is the fact that they're fighting each other as much as they're fighting the bad guy. These are people who kind of expect to star in their own movie. So when you put them together, there's a lot of interpersonal conflict. You know, Tony Stark has his iron suit and likes to be a superhero, but mostly he likes to be the center of attention. Robert Downey Jr., with his sarcastic personality, butts heads and hammers and everything else with Thor, who is a god, basically, and has a personal stake in this. And then Captain America is in there trying to be, you know, the mediator and get everybody to behave themselves. And it just goes on like this and brings a lot of humor and a lot of personality to the story. There are tons of just epic action scenes, especially towards the end. Lots of little inside jokes and sarcastic references, and it's great, great fun. It's very long, and I've talked to people who thought that it took a while to get going, although, I mean, it starts with a car jeep chase through collapsing tunnels and all sorts of other things, so I'm not sure how that qualifies as slow. To me, it never really slowed down at all. The press screening was in IMAX 3D, and I have to say the 3D on this thing is absolutely gorgeous. Usually it tends to be kind of blurry and the backgrounds don't look quite right, but this is very clear. There's real depth to it. This is one of the few times that I didn't feel like it was just a gimmick. It really works very, very well. So, gosh. Should I give it a 4 or 5? I think I might give it a 5. I
really?
At least wow. 4.5. I had so much fun watching this. I will say, you know, that the dialogue does occasionally get kind of clunky, and it is hard to juggle that many characters successfully. But, you know, they get awfully close. So let's do 4.5. We'll put it just shy of a 5.
All right. You know, I know that there were some midnight screenings last night of The Avengers. If you've seen it, let us know what you thought. Give us a call at 816-235-2888 or send us a note at centralstandard@kcur.org. You know, we are a call-in show, and that's also keeping in the legacy of the Walt Bodine Show. You're the most important factor in this, and we want to hear from you. So go ahead and give us a call, 816-235-2888. When it comes to Marvel's The Avengers, Lori, I think you and I are pretty much on the same page. I thought this was a very, very strong superhero movie. It does have everything that you've come to expect, the great special effects, the great action sequences, all of the art direction and production values that, you know, have been the characteristic of these great Marvel comic book movies. But I think what really made it good was what you said the dialogue was sometimes clunky. I thought the dialogue was really good.
No, most of the time it's very sharp, but yeah. There's always these little bits of exposition and explaining what's happening that has to come in that doesn't always ring right. But
that's Whedon's, I think, best contribution is that he gives his characters some really good lines.
He's a great writer.
He is.
Yeah.
He's terrific. But even that, beyond that, you're talking about a superhero movie. It's really hard to make the audience feel that these characters are in real peril because they have superpowers. So what do you, you know, how do you make that, what do you do as a director to create that tension, to create a real palpable sense that there's some peril involved here? That's one of the flaws of many superhero movies. Somehow, Whedon pulls it off. I was concerned. I said, who's going to get knocked off here? And when you can do that, when you can make me suspend my disbelief to the point where I was really feeling like the characters are in peril, then you've done something really well. And I agree with that. I'm going to give it a 4. So I think between the two of us, let's say 4.5.
Sure.
For Marvel's The Avengers, rated PG-13. It's the first summer blockbuster of the year, so summer is officially here as far as Hollywood is concerned.
Getting off to a good start.
You know, they did something also that was really smart. They opened this film in foreign markets first before they brought it over here. One of the problems that Hollywood has had on an ongoing basis is that there's pirating going on, in, particularly outside of the U.S. So open it there first before the pirates can get a hold of it here, you know, and get it overseas. And they've had huge box office success for this movie.
Of course, then the people who want to see it early in America get the pirated copies from overseas. Probably best to just open it at the same time everywhere.
That may be true, too. But the movie has done fantastic. It's going to be a huge box office hit, no matter what anybody says. But speaking of Josh Whedon, Whedon had a film that he was involved with that opened a few weeks ago that we did not get a chance to talk about. And I know Loi and Marie have seen it. Who'd like to talk about Cabin in the Woods?
Oh, I'll go ahead and start it. Cabin in the Woods, the title kind of gives it away, you think, because, ooh, Cabin in the Woods, it's going to be a spooky film. You know, it's probably grade B, and we've got the teens or the young adults, and they're off with the camping trip, and they get lost in the woods, and, oh, my gosh, there's a cabin, and it's getting dark. We're going to have to spend the night, you know, and then people start disappearing. And then we have a nice little twist here, which I'm not going to talk about, but that twist follows through, and it really took me by surprise, and I really liked it. And as in The Raven, which we'll talk about before, there's an ending that is a satisfactory ending, but it's really not what you expect. Now, Chris Hemsworth, who plays Thor in The Avengers, is also in this film, which was made way before The Avengers, actually. I think it sat on a shelf.
3 years ago, yeah.
Yeah. So they're out at the same time. So, you know, his name in box office is really going to be high. I don't remember the rest of the cast members here, but I do remember him because he's one of my favorite actors now. I'm going to give this a 3, and because sidestep, if you're a blood and gore person, you know, be aware of this film. But it is better made than you might think, and I'm going to give it a 3 rating.
Yeah, it's The blood and gore thing, obviously, I don't really have a big problem with that. But it turns out to be kind of an epic story in a way that you don't expect from the setup like you're talking about. And I think sometimes it bites off a little more than it can chew, philosophically speaking. There are some plot holes that emerge towards the end where you're like, yeah, you should have thought about that a little more. But it deals with a lot of the – I mean, it's almost like a straight adrenaline shot of Joss Whedon and Drew Goddard, who is his director and who also used to work on the Buffy and Angel franchises with him. If you've seen any of those things, then you're going to recognize a lot of the themes and some of the mythology that emerges in this. And it is at times quite scary. I mean, there's zombies running around the woods and all kinds of insanity that emerges, especially towards the end. I can't wait for the DVD so I can freeze frame all the little background stuff. Other cast member Richard Jenkins and Bradley Whitford,
Richard
two
Jenkins,
great
yes.
character
uh-huh.
actors, have absolutely terrific roles in this. So it's a horror movie that's about being a horror movie. So it's very metatextual, but quite interesting, also very funny. You know, these guys, they're just very talented. And I love that this is coming out right ahead of the Avengers. It was held up because MGM went bankrupt and it had to find a new distributor.
The accidental timing is actually
working,
right?
Yeah, I mean, it ended up being quite perfect. But it really gives you more of a sense of what somebody like Whedon can do when he's not adapting other people's material as he is with the Avengers, which it's a lot of fun, but you have to be in the right mood for it, especially when it gets towards the end. But I'm going to give it a 4.
All right, so that's a 4 and a 3, so we'll average that out to a 3.5 for Cabin in the Woods, which is rated R. And speaking of blood and gore, you were just bringing that up in regards to Cabin in the Woods. We're going to have a very special guest joining us after the at the end of the half hour here, right after in the next half of the show. His name is Darren Lim Bousman, and he is a filmmaker from Overland Park originally, raised in Overland Park. And he has the distinction, if we understand correctly, of being the first director in Hollywood history to have all three of his first three films open at number one at the box office. Saw 2, Saw 3, and Saw 4, all directed by Darren. And those were all huge hits. The one that made the least amount of money at the box office domestically made $130 million. So we're not going to be having a fundraiser for Darren anytime soon. But he is going to be talking to us about a new film that he's got he's bringing into town to show tomorrow night. It's called The Devil's Carnival. We'll be talking about that after the half hour, so please stick around for that. And in the meantime, you can call us at 816-235-2888 or send us a note at centralstandard@kcur.org. Let's take a step back and talk about a movie that opened back on April 27th. It's a animated film called Pirates, Band of Misfits. Marie?
I went to see this at the new AMC Theater at Ward Parkway that has remodeled with all these lush seats. And I went to an afternoon matinee, and there were two teenage boys sitting next to me, and they promptly fell asleep all the way through the movie. They were so comfortable.
What were they doing there?
But I thought this was a lot of fun. It's from, Aardman. They call them Aardman Animation. I wanted to say Aardman Studios, but that's if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Famous for the Gromit and Wallace and Gromit films. But this one takes on the pirates. And Band of Misfits, certainly, and it's a kind of a convoluted story. I thought it was a little difficult for children to follow, and I thought it was overly long by maybe 10 or 15 minutes. It goes about an hour and 40 minutes. Some of the voices may not be familiar to you. For example, Hugh Grant plays the lead pirate, and the only one that I would have recognized if I had closed my eyes and listened was Martin Freeman, who plays one of the pirates who is the logical one. He thinks through the situations where the other ones are ready to just go full force and try something out. We bring in Queen Victoria, who turns out to be a villain. She's head of a group that goes out and hunts exotic animals to eat. Now, there are such groups around the world, so they zero in on this rather graphically, I thought, for the rating. But the main plot is the pirate wants to be known as the main pirate, and they're trying to find treasure and everything else, and they've got a bird with them that they don't realize is a treasure. It's the last dodo bird. And so we get Charles Darwin in here, who they rob, and they think he's got treasure. And he says, well, you're looking at the treasure. This bird on the shoulder is the last one alive. You know, this is your treasure. and little things like that. It might be a little too detailed for children, so maybe children over the age of 8 might pick up on these things rather than a young child. However, the young kids at the screening that I saw seemed to be content in watching it. The stop-action animation is wonderfully done, especially one where it shows the boat going around the globe, and they're going from one place to the other, and they land on an island like Australia, which boots them over to another place, which kicks them over to another place, and those graphics are fun. I'm going to give it 3.5.
Lori?
Well, like all of Aardman's movies, this is really great to look at. It's that sort of claymation, stop-motion style that they're famous for. The press screening I went to was in 3D, and I actually think this probably would have worked better in 2D because there's such detail to their work. And this one does get kind of blurry and the lighting's not quite right. So I would rather actually look at it in 2D because I think you probably would pick up on more. And this is a kind of movie where everything that works about it for me is around the edges. It's little shots in the background. It's a little throwaway line. It's these little clever things that are spinning around the edges. The primary story, it rubbed me the wrong way at almost every turn. It was too convoluted. And there was a real mean-spirited quality to it. You know, it wasn't much comic violence as this sort of people really attacking each other and doing really quite horrible things. And the descendants of Queen Victoria and Charles Darwin probably have a libel suit, defamation of character. They're really portrayed as just awful, awful people. I don't know. I think we took my nephew to see it. He's 7. And he said he liked it, but you can always tell whether he's talking about it a few days later. He didn't say anything else about this movie afterward. And in fact, he was asking questions after about, you know, kind of why are these people doing those things to each other? And why did, you know, I think it bothered him a little bit that it was just so, really, it's just very mean-spirited quality to it that I found off-putting. And to me, the stuff that was really worthwhile was not the focus. It should have been the focus. And they kind of got it backwards a little bit, I think. So I can only really give it maybe a 2.5.
You know, I think I'm probably leaning a little bit more toward Loie on this one, although I enjoyed the film as I was watching it. I don't think it ever, well, to use the cliche, ever hits full sail for a pirate movie. But the voice characters, fine. The script, cute. But the movie just didn't feel inspired to me. The visuals were spectacular, you know, as they always are in Aardman movies. It's a combination, as you said, of stop-motion animation and computer graphics, seamless from what I can see. But the movie does have that, as you say, that kind of a little bit of a mean spirit to it. It just never quite hit its stride. So I'm going to give it a 3. So how about averaging it out to a 3 for the three of us?
I think I may have said that it had a G rating. It's PG rating.
PG is right. Okay, that's Pirates Band of Misfits, and we're giving that a rating of 3. You're listening to Central Standard Friday. Give us a call, 816-235-2888, or send us a note at centralstandard@kcur.org. There's a movie that also opened back on the 27th that I'm just going to touch on really quickly. It's a comedy called The 5-Year Engagement, and this is Jason Segel, who is a very talented guy. We all know him from the Muppet movie, and we know him from Forgetting Sarah Marshall. And he's reunited with the writer and director, or the director, he is the writer, of Forgetting Sarah Marshall. And this is a movie where he stars with Emily Blunt as a couple who are obviously in love, but circumstances prevent them from tying the knot, obviously, for 5 years. There are some funny moments. It's kind of sweet-natured, but I couldn't help but feel like the movie was going to last 5 years. It's way too long to sustain the pace, and it's very episodic. It moves in fits and starts, and it doesn't really ever have any kind of a strong feeling of momentum. And so I'm only going to be able to give it a 2.5, and it is rated R, and boy, by golly, it earns that R rating. It's a raunchy comedy that's The 5-Year Engagement, rated R.
And Jason Segel really has a good spring going because his film, Jeff Who Lives at Home, is still in town and spreading by word of mouth.
Right. There was a movie that opened back on April 20th. It's a Nicholas Sparks adaptation called The Lucky One. Marie?
Oh, you kind of wonder if Nicholas Sparks would ever kind of go away from his formula and not so in The Lucky One. He has gorgeous actors, and you wonder if an ordinary person who doesn't look like the beautiful Taylor Schilling or Zac Efron would be cast. But this is a story about a man who is in the service. He's stationed overseas, and there's a bomb blast, and he picks up a photograph of a woman, and while he's looking at it, there's another blast, and because he wasn't standing in that previous spot, this picture, he thinks, saves him. So he gets back to the United States. He tries to find out who it is, but he doesn't have the courage to tell her when he finds her. And everything is so coincidental. He has a dog, and gosh, you know, she runs a kennel, dog walking service. She's divorced, and the husband is kind of a bad guy. And, of course, he and Zach kind of clash at this. But everybody wonders why Zach is actually in town. He's already bought a house. But he's kind of in the background because he's really falling for her. And the wonderful Lithdanner is the mother or grandmother, Ellie. And her little one-liners are what really make the script. And everybody else seems to be kind of reciting lines, unfortunately. But when she's on there, it's acting. And so it's a beautifully paced film as far as photography. It reminds me of War Horse, you know, cue the sunset and here it is. Cue the animals and there they are. Have the little boy smile and there he is. Follows the same pattern over here. And it's rather slow towards the end. Many coincidences. Zac Efron is a musician, so her son wants to play the violin, so he's able to help him, you know, things like that. So unfortunately, I'm going to give it a 2. I wish it had a little bit more spirit in it, but it didn't.
You know, this is a movie that's a Nicholas Sparks adaptation. If you like Nicholas Sparks movies, like The Notebook and, The Long Walk Home, help me out, Road to
did he do
Rodanthe.
Did he do about the
Knights in Rodanthe, yeah.
Yeah.
He's got a built-in following, people that love his books, and that's fine. If that's your thing, you probably will enjoy this movie. As I was watching it, within the first 15 minutes, I thought, I know exactly where this is going and how it will end, and I was right. And I think if you don't, if you haven't figured it out shortly in the first reel, then you probably haven't seen too many movies. I did like Zac Efron. I think he's maturing nicely as an actor. I think he's, as the Marine character, he was believable. It's just that it felt to me like they were just going through the paces. And so I'm going to agree with you, Marie. I'm going to give it a 2.5, and that is The Lucky One, rated PG-13. You know, if you like that sort of thing,
yeah.
It's right up your alley.
You said it. There are Nicholas Sparks fans out there. They'll go, just like we have Josh Whedon fans here who will go to see
I like Blythe Danner, but I don't know if I'd watch this just for her.
And there's another movie that opened back on April 20th, a G-rated documentary from Disney called Chimpanzee. And this is pretty much also exactly what you'd expect. It's a beautifully filmed nature documentary. It takes place in parts of the Congo, and it's the exploits of a group of chimpanzees. And the only downside of this that I could see was that it wasn't any better than anything you can see on the Animal Planet. You know, there are lots of documentaries, and it's nicely done. It's competent. I'm not sure it's worth the money to see it on the big screen. But it's a movie that I think at times will maybe be a little off-putting to the kids. It's a G-rated movie, but it is somewhat violent. They do downplay some of the more horrific elements, you know, because, hey, these are chimpanzees, and they're battling one another to the death, and sometimes they're cannibalizing one another. And so this kind of could be upsetting to little kids, even though they don't show it graphically on screen.
G rating?
And it does have a G rating, yes.
Well, another example of how messed up the rating system is.
That's right.
Okay.
So I'm going to give it a 3 just because it's so beautifully filmed, and that's Chimpanzee from Disney, rated G. We're up against a break, so we're going to take that break now. We're going to be talking with Darren Bousman after the break, who's the director of Saw 2, 3, and 4, and an Overland Park native. And we'll be touching base and also giving you some ideas what you can do over the weekend, some announcements as far as movies are concerned. And that's coming up on Central Standard Friday. And welcome. welcome back to Central Standard Friday. My name is Russ Simmons, and it's Movie Critic Day here on Central Standard Friday. And we're going to be continuing our discussion of some of the movies that have opened over the past 3 weeks here in the Kansas City metro area. We're also going to be talking very shortly with Darren Lynn Bousman, the filmmaker from Overland Park, who's had tremendous success in Hollywood. He'll be joining us momentarily. I'm joined today by Marie Asner and Loie Lockerbie, and we want you to call us at 816-235-2888 or send us a note at centralstandard@kcur.org. Just a few quick announcements of some things that are coming up that we want to make sure that we inform you about. The Tivoli will be continuing its very popular performing arts series. These are high-definition broadcasts from the world's great stages. There's opera, ballet, national theater, live broadcasts. And coming up, the Royal Ballet will be having a performance on May 16th and 20th, and La Scala Opera on May 17th. And also at the Tivoli, we have a documentary called Hollywood to Dollywood, one show only. And that's Thursday, May 10th at 7:30, and all the proceeds benefit the Good Samaritan Project. That's, of course, a documentary about fanboys who love Dolly Parton. And also a documentary called Strong, which is about women's weightlifting, will be free at the Tivoli on Saturday, May 12th at 11 a.m. And here's one I'm kind of excited about, The Beatles, The Lost Concert, Tuesday, May 22nd at 7:30. And this was a concert footage from 1964 that has been unseen for 47 years, that took place in Washington, D.C., and that's all at the Tivoli. You can find out more information at tivolikc.com.
Yes, Mom, we're going.
And something that Loie might be able to tell us a little bit about, Real Smart Trivia, which takes place at the Screenland Armor on Sundays at 6 p.m. What's that like, Loie?
Well, I've only been once, but it's great fun. You get teams together. And basically it's 2 hours of movie-related trivia, and you can win money. My team won, and in fact, I think at least last week, a team with some of our film critic buddies won. But don't feel too intimidated, because there are some really good non-professional teams up there, too. And even there's a couple of them who, even when they get the answers wrong, they're usually very funny about it. So it's a good time, and you sit and eat and drink and answer questions and, you know, hopefully walk home with a little cash. So
there you go. And that's at the Screenland Arbor on Sundays at 6 p.m. And we have at the Screenland Crown Center, Screenland Slams. It's a kind of like imagining Mystery Science Theater 3000, but with live, local, and uncensored improv comics who are turned loose on some of the best worst movies in film history, and they rip them to shreds. And they're going to be doing Showgirls on May 5th. At 9 p.m. at the Screenland Crown Center. And you can find out more about those events at screenland.com. And finally, the Kansas City Public Library is, as always, does a great job of showing classic films. They're going to be showing Meet Me in St. Louis tomorrow at 1:30 at the Central Library, Father of the Bride May 7th at 6:30 p.m. at the Central Library, and one that, in particular, Kansas Cityans will be interested in, Mr. and Mrs. Bridge, the film that starred Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward from 1990 that was filmed here in Kansas City, is going to be shown Friday, May 11th at 1 p.m. at the Westport Branch. You're listening to Central Standard. Give us a call, 816-235-2888, or send us a note at centralstandard@kcur.org. I want to thank Darren Lynn Bousman, who's been waiting patiently on the phone to chat with us. Darren, welcome aboard.
Hello. How are you guys?
Fine, thank you.
We're doing great. So you're calling us from St. Louis, is that right?
No, where am I? I'm in Chicago right now.
You're in Chicago.
Yeah, it's crazy. I kind of forget where I am sometimes. We're on this 40-city tour, and every morning we're in a different city, and so sometimes I kind of blend together.
This is kind of an interesting experiment that you're doing. Tell us a little bit about what it is.
Yeah, you know, I went to film school about 10 years ago, and I had extreme luck with the Saw films. I directed Saw 2, 3, and 4 right out of film school. And then after that, my movies have had a hard time finding homes. I did a movie called Repo, the Genetic Opera, and it was released in only a handful of screens. And then after that, Mother's Day I made, and it's just now being released 3 years later today. Today it actually opens up. And then this other film, 1111, and as a filmmaker and an artist, it kind of hurts when you spend all this time working on something and you can't find a release pattern for it. So a couple of my friends and I got together and said, let's just do it ourselves. Let's go off and make our own movie, and let's distribute it ourselves. And that's what we're doing. We shot this thing called The Devil's Carnival, which is a kind of a weird musical a la Rocky Horror Picture Show, kind of the anti-Glee. And we went off and shot it, and we are self-distributing it, and we're showing up to every single screening. And we're living basically out of a van, and it's kind of fun and different, and it's exciting. And we have cast that comes with us. Like, for example, we'll be in Kansas City tomorrow, and we have Emily Autumn and Sean from Clown from Slipknot coming with us, and Servino shows up from time to time at some of these stops. So it's just this kind of crazy, fun touring carnival.
And it's interesting that you said that you're showing this, and I understand it's going to be at the Glenwood Arts, which is at the corner of 95th and Metcalf in Overland Park, and that's at 9:30 tomorrow night. And I talked with actually Brian Mossman, the proprietor of the theater,
yeah.
And I think it's going to be very full. So look into getting your tickets right away, because hope we don't want anyone turned away at the door.
Yeah, it's it's what's cool about what we're doing, and I think why I'm so excited by it is that it's not just a screening, and that's one thing that we try to get away from. Anyone can go just watch a movie. There's no reason for me to come and be on 40 stops just to watch a movie. So we kind of turn every event into something different or unique. We have sideshows and freak shows that open the event up, burlesque dancers, contest giveaways, question and answers, meet and greets, signings. And we actually try to turn each screening into an event to kind of make going back to movies fun, because I think that, you know, when I grew up, it's funny that we're going back to the Glenwood Arts Theater, because when I was growing up in Kansas, that was the theater that my mom would take me to for double features on Saturday afternoons. And it was something I looked forward to all week. And I think that it's kind of lost its charm to some extent going to see a movie. It's become more of a machine than it has an experience. And so we're trying to make, again, going to the movies fun again.
Now, you said that you grew up in Overland Park. And where did you go to high school?
Shawnee Mission North.
And what year did you graduate, if you don't mind me asking?
I don't remember.
Blocked it out.
Good
back.
Answer.
I'm 33, so I guess if you try to backtrack that to when I was 17 years old, I want to say it was like 96, 97, but I totally might be wrong, but I think it was 97.
And you also went for a time to KU, did you not?
I did. I was in KU for 2.5 years. So I went through, 2.5 years at KU. And then, you know, when I was in KU, I was in the film program there, and I finally just decided that if I really want to do this, if I really want to make it, I've got to go out and just start it. And so I went to a technical-based film school for a year and then moved directly to Los Angeles.
My question, and this is Marie Asner.
Hello.
Hi. In your biography, you went to Full Sail University in Winter Park, Florida. Is that the technical school? Because that is a school that has an unusual name, and I was wondering.
Yeah.
Because many film schools have specific areas, like one will be directing, one will be cinematography, and so on. So, but the technical aspects, this is the school that you went to?
Yeah, Full Sail. It's a kind of a crazy, it was a crazy school, and I just went back actually recently on this road tour. We stopped and showed the movie to the students. And it's kind of undefinable, the school. It's not like other film schools. Basically, the classes run 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and you could run any time in a 13-hour period. So, for example, you could have class at 1 a.m. on Sunday morning, and that will take you to 1 p.m. Monday afternoon. And they do that to basically get you ready and prepare you for what it's like in the entertainment industry in these kind of long, crazy hours. And so I've been doing – so going there, it was – 13 months or 14 months, 7 days a week. You had a few days off for Christmas, and that was basically it. But it's cool because they put the camera directly in your hands. There's no talking about it or philosophizing about it. They give you the 35-millimeter camera and say, go out and let's start making films, which was something that I really responded to.
Oh, that's a creative school.
Yeah. And
it's
also cool because there, all the instructors were people that were in the industry. So there's a rotating group of instructors. So, for example, there you might have someone that worked on Titanic or X-Men that are teaching your classes, not someone that, you know, talks and wants to be a filmmaker. You're actually talking to filmmakers, which was something unique that not a lot of other schools offered.
Oh, great. Thank
now,
you.
Yeah, it seems interesting to me that your first three films made huge money at the box office. As a matter of fact, I was looking at the numbers, and I think the one that made the least amount of money was like over $130
million. Yeah.
So how is it possible, and I don't understand the vagaries of Hollywood, that here's a tremendously successful director who's made three giant movies, and then he has difficulty getting his films financed?
Yeah, if I knew the answer to that, I'd be a much happier man. you know what I think it is? I think that for lack of a better kind of analogy, Hollywood is a machine, and it's also a business, the movie business. And Hollywood's not in the business of making movies that don't make money. They want to make things that appeal to middle America, that appeal to people in Overland Park, Kansas. And I think that my kind of desires and what moves me and inspires me is not necessarily always inside that model. Repo, the Genetic Opera, I mean, it's a rock opera with Paris Hilton and Sarah Brightman and Paul Sorvino, which is kind of a weird, undefinable thing. And I think that when you make something like that, it's hard. I think that it would be much easier for me if I went out and said, I want to go make Saw 8 or 9. Then I don't think I would have that big of a problem. But since my passion kind of lies in these weird, out of the box kind of films, it's much harder for filmmakers, I think.
I'd just like to get your feedback on a term that has become part of the Hollywood lexicon, and that is torture porn. What is your take on that?
I mean, here's the thing. It's funny is that violent films, violence in general, has been around since the beginning of the written word, and extremely vicious violence. Going back to cinema in the early 70s and even in the 60s at some point, these type of films existed. I mean, be it Hills Have Eyes or Last House on the Left or Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer, they've always been there. And I think the difference is when we started making these films, when the Rob Zombies and the James Wans and the Eli Roths and myself, they were just more accessible to people because of the internet, because of social media. So all of a sudden, these films that might have been, grindhousey video nasties, now had a much bigger audience because that audience could communicate. And so they had to give it a name, they had to label it something, and they call it torture porn. It's funny. I think that I definitely have seen some movies that are exploitative for exploitative sake, movies that are again vicious and just violent for the sake of being it. I wouldn't call a lot of the films that are labeled torture porn though torture porn. To me, that connotates someone that is basically just misogynistic and killing for the sake of killing. And I think a lot of films get mislabeled that. Some films rightfully deserve the title, but then when I look at something like a Saw film be labeled that, I kind of scratch my head because I don't think it's masochistic or any of that kind of. But it's funny. I mean, I think people look for labels to put on things, and sadly, some of the films that myself and my fellow filmmakers were kind of labeled into that.
Is Devil's Carnival a sequel to Repo?
No, it's not. Basically, Repo was it was my passion project for over 10 years. I started directing on a stage. I was the director of the stage play of it, and I kind of followed it through its inception as a film. But after we released it, we sold it to Lionsgate. And, at the very end, it was not a profitable movie for Lionsgate, but it was something that, again, made myself happy, and I basically got a huge cult following around the film. The movie Repo was only released in a handful of theaters. I think it was released in 12 theaters when it first came out. 2 years later, it was in 300 theaters and midnights all over, and people were shadow casting it. And then a year after that, the theaters doubled. And so this little movie kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger because of that kind of midnight audience for it. And so when we decided to make the next one, we decided, or our next kind of musical, we decided just to do it completely, again, start back to square one, but let's us control it, let's us own it, let's us pull all the, control the trailers and the promotional material and everything like that. Because, again, this is a movie that not everyone's going to get. And the worst thing you can try to do is to try to put a movie like this in a machine, which they're not. That's not what they're made for. They're made for the bigger movies, the movies that do appeal to mass audiences. And I'll be the first to admit, this is a love or hate it kind of movie, and that's what's kind of fun about these screenings that we're doing. You know in the first 30 seconds if you're in or you're not in. And if you're not in the first 30 seconds, you have a horrible next 2 hours ahead of you. And I kind of like that as being a polarizing director. I mean, even this film I have coming out today, Mother's Day, it's one of my favorite films that I've directed, and it stars Rebecca De Mornay in it. And it's one of those movies that after I started screening it, I was getting praised as being my best film, yet others were saying it's absolutely my worst film. And I kind of love that, how the movie itself can polarize an audience, and there's no middle ground. It's either a love or hate it kind of thing, and I think those are the kind of movies I've become known for, is the love or hate it.
You're listening to Central Standard Friday here on KCUR. Give us a call at 816-235-2888. Or send us an email at centralstandard@kcur.org.
Well, I noticed we were talking about Devil's Carnival, and even though it's not actually a sequel to Repo, you are using some of the same cast members. How did that come about?
I like working with my friends, I think, more than anything. I mean, here's the thing. I think I'm kind of unconventional. I'm probably going to get in trouble for all these, how vocal I am on things. But, you know, to me, I never wanted to work a 9-to-5 job. I wanted to do something that I enjoyed doing. I woke up every morning and I was excited about doing it. I think I'm lucky in the fact that I work with my friends. From the crew members that I work with to the actors, like, example, Bill Moseley and Alexa Vega and Paul Sorvino. These are all people that are my dear friends that I hang out with on the weekends, that come to my wedding, that, you know, we just go out and hang out. And so when it comes time for me to do a project and know that how stressful it gets when you're making a movie and how stressful it gets when you're, you know, in production, I want to be surrounded by people that I'm not, that there's no kind of drama with. And so that's how I basically choose who I put in my movies, or people that I'm friends with.
The Devil's Carnival will screen at 9:30 tomorrow night at the Glenwood Arts at 95th and Metcalf. I would suggest you give them a call to make sure that you can get a ticket. So
devilscarnival.com is where you want to get tickets if you're looking for tickets. There's still about 25, 30 tickets available, and have a chance to go meet Clown from Slipknot and Emily Autumn, myself, and the lead actor, Terrence Zadunich.
Thanks so much, Darren. I appreciate you calling
in. Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much.
Look forward to seeing it tomorrow night. All righty. So, once again, you're listening to Central Standard Friday here on KCUR. 816-235-2888 is the number. centralstandard@kcur.org is the email address. Picking up where we left off, we're going to be talking about a movie that opened back on April 20th. Marie, tell us a little bit about a very popular movie that's done really well at the box office called Think Like a Man.
Well, I tell you right off the bat, you almost have to see this film twice, because I think everybody in Hollywood who was able to stand up and hold a script is in this movie. It centers on four main couples, and Steve Harvey has written a book about Act Like a Lady, Think Like a Man, so this is kind of a turnaround on that. So we follow four women who are unhappy with their love situations, you know, it's a divorced or a broke up with the boyfriend or so on. And through various situations, they overhear Steve Harvey being interviewed about the book, or they see it in a bookstore, and then they start reading it and following it. And they say, the next person I meet, I'm going to try these rules on. So instead of, you know, sleeping on the first date, we're going to stretch it out to, it has to be 5 dates before we kiss and everything. And then we go to the man's viewpoint. And some of these guys, you think, good grief, who would date them? But everybody, you know, finds their match, and it goes along through this. I will say, though, that everybody in this cast, and I really mean everybody, overacts. They just don't say their lines. They really shout their lines, and there's hand gestures, and we just don't make an entrance or an exit. It's a big entrance or an exit. And, I mean, you're watching this for 2 hours, and you're thinking, wow, I'm kind of overwhelmed. And you miss the story, who gets together with who. And I was a little disappointed in that. I'm going to stretch it to a 3 for production values, because that was great. But it's a little mixed up in there as far as following people as to what happens to them.
I think what really makes this movie work is the cast. You have a very, very likable cast. Kevin Hart, who may be the one you're complaining about with his gestures, but he is hilarious. He's really over the top. He's an over the top comic. If you're looking for really good romantic advice, this is not the movie for that. This is very sitcom, rom-com, very slick Hollywood, but again, saved by a likable cast. So I'll agree with you, Marie. I'll give it a 3 for Think Like a Man, rated PG-13. Loie was going to tell us about a film that she caught for us. It's opening today at the Glenwood?
I think it's the Rio.
It's the Rio, okay. It's called We Have a Pope with No Rating.
Yeah, this was a pleasant little surprise. It's an Italian film by Nanni Moretti, and stars Michele Piccoli. So if you're familiar with Italian cinema, those names might mean something. But anyway, it's a fictionalized account of a man who is appointed pope and basically has a nervous breakdown in response. it really gets inside. I don't know how they got access to this information, or if it's just all made up, but it goes inside the conclave where the cardinals are choosing the new pope, and the least likely guy, you would think, is the one they end up voting for, and he's just completely overwhelmed. And just as they're announcing his, you know, and then there's crowds down there in Vatican City, and he just completely has a panic attack and disappears. He just takes off at some point and disappears into the streets of Rome. And then back at the Vatican, his assistant is trying desperately to keep everyone from finding out what's going on. And so you've got all these cardinals who are stuck there because they're not allowed to leave. And there's a psychologist they brought in to help him who can't do anything now. And he's an atheist, so he's in there surrounded by all these cardinals. And eventually they all start, you know, playing cards and organizing volleyball tournaments while they wait to find out what's going on. So it's a very funny, very sweet-natured movie. It does have a little serious side to it, talking about, you know, what happens to someone who has this incredible responsibility thrust upon them and doesn't know how to handle it. But you know, for the most part, it's got this very gentle humor, and I enjoyed it quite a bit. I'll give it 3.5.
Wow.
That reminds me of Anthony Quinn's film Shoes of the Fisherman of many years ago, where he's elected pope and he feels he's so humble. And he puts himself in disguise and he goes out and talks to the people there very humbly and asks questions about being the pope. But that's done seriously. This one is humorously.
Yeah, they say there is some seriousness to it. But, you know, it's really about this guy finding himself by disappearing and being a normal person for a while.
I had the opportunity about 10 years ago to see on Broadway the production of Terence Rattigan's famous play, The Deep Blue Sea, with Blythe Danner and Edward Herman in the lead roles. And terrific production, very interesting. Well, they've made a movie out of it. It stars Rachel Weisz, the Oscar-winning actress. It's a story that's set in 1952, and Weisz plays the wife of a wealthy British judge. She has this torrid affair with an RAF pilot played by Tom Hiddleston, who's Loki.
Loki, yes.
Loki in the Marvel's The Avengers.
Wow.
She attempts suicide when she finds that after a while her lover's affections aren't reciprocated. And then she has to have this relationship with her husband, the judge, and try to figure out how to cope and so on. So it's not exactly a musical comedy. Let's just put it that way. This is a very dour, very austere drama, very well acted, but it's very slowly paced. And it's not a movie that that you're looking for a date night, but it's well made and it kind of grows on you very slowly. So it does manage to have some power, but you really have to be patient with this kind of a movie. I'm going to give it a 3, mainly because of the acting involved. Rachel Weisz is very good. So that's the 3 for The Deep Blue Sea, which is rated R. And Maria, you saw a film for us called Safe, rated R.
Yes, I'll make it short. It's another Jason Statham action film. If you don't have enough of him, he's coming out this summer in The Expendables also, so this is his spring into summer. He's thinking of committing suicide because he double-crossed the Russian mob who killed his wife. But then he saves a young Oriental girl and finds out that she's being hunted also by the same criminals because they're using her mind as a computer. She's extremely intelligent with mathematics, and so she keeps all the numbers of their rackets and everything in there, and she doesn't like this, and she's run away. So then the rest of the film is chase after chase, rescue after rescue. It has a satisfactory ending, and he does good on it, so I'll give it 2.5.
2.5 for Safe, rated R, another Jason Statham action movie. Writer, director, star Gianni Di Gregorio, and I wanted to work that in just so I could say Gianni Di Gregorio,
okay.
Stars in a gentle Italian comedy called The Salt of Life. It's a kind of a semi-autobiographical movie about a retiree who's very put upon but very kind-hearted, sweet-natured guy who is learning that all of his buddies, or many of them, are scoring with the young chicks. So he wants that opportunity, too, to give his a little salt of life, a little spice to his life. And this could be one of those ugly, leering, dirty old man type of movies. But in De Gregorio's hands, it's kind of sweet-natured. And actually, you find yourself at some point actually rooting for him to cheat on his wife. But at the same time, all of his efforts come to naught because it's just one episode after another of failure.
Is this subtitled, Russ?
It is subtitled, yes. It's an Italian film. And sweet, not great. But the only downside is that it's slow-moving, episodic, doesn't really have much of a pace, and frankly, anticlimactic. But funny, and it's a nice little character study. And that's Salt of Life. No rating, it's playing around town. And also wanted to ask you guys if there's – is there anything coming up this summer that you say, I can't wait to catch it?
Dark Knight Rises.
I think so, yes.
Yeah.
And finally, Marie, you wanted to tell us about one you caught for us called The Raven.
Yes, and I'll make this short also. John Cusack does do a good Edgar Allan Poe. It's toward the end of Poe's life. There's a serial killer on the loose who is killing according to the short stories that Poe had written before this. And when his fiancée is kidnapped, well, then Poe comes into it with the help of the detective. And from then on, it's kind of like a Sherlock Holmes, Dr. Watson kind of thing. It has a satisfactory, unusual ending. I think we're talking about unusual endings in this program today. I thought the production values were good. And if you're an Edgar Allan Poe fan, you will follow the titles of the stories that are used that the killer chooses to murder by. If not, it's going to be more like CSI, but I'm going to give it a 3.
You know, I was a little curious to ask you this. When I saw that John Cusack was being cast as Edgar Allan Poe, I don't know. I wasn't sure if I was going to buy that. I haven't seen it, so I'm keeping an open mind. How did he do?
He did very well, and he was also aided by that long cloak that that Sherlock Holmes always wears, too. So,
was he drunk the whole time?
No. Well, yes. I mean, he was toward the end of his career, but he does well at it.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us on the very first Central Standard Friday. This is Russ Simmons. Join us for also the Food Critics and the History Show, rotating in this time slot every Friday. Our show is produced by Andrea Salinzi. Our announcer is Kim Noble. Thanks to my fellow movie critics today. I'm Russ Simmons. This is Central Standard Fridays. Enjoy your day.